This week on A to Z Running, we finish our series on wise decisions, talking about different ways to manage energy, emotion, and stress.
We also answer a listener question about cool down jogs after hard efforts and races.
In the world of running, Boston Marathon was a nail biter, but for two totally different reasons in the men's and women's races.
College kids continue to assault the records boards.
And from the headlines, Strava is being called into question yet again.
All this and more on A to Z Running.
Welcome back to A to Z Running, where we help runners thrive with information, inspiration, and coaching and training services. I'm Andy.
And I'm Zach, and you can learn everything about the stuff we do and how we support runners at atozrunning.com. Look for the word coaching in the menu, if that's what you're interested in. And you can follow us on the places where you find stuff, like Instagram, Spotify, and YouTube.
And Connor found us on Instagram and sent a nice message saying, "Thanks for your last podcast episode. I PR'd in my most recent marathon. I kept talking to myself in second person. You can do this, etc." So congratulations, nice. Connor. And I love that that helped you. There's so many tricks that we can imply or impose, imply? Apply to help us, especially because a lot of what we're doing during a marathon is trying to continue to convince our bodies to move and keep moving and keep going fast.
Yeah. But also, listen, Connor, you PR'd because you did that.
Right.
Exactly. It had almost nothing to do with our suggestion to talk to yourself in second person.
That's true. So like you can't,
minimal help.
You can't like make up fitness with a bunch of you cans. But you can unlock your potential by having a good mindset. So you got to have the fitness though, that there's no faking a marathon.
And in fact, when we talk about it here in just a bit to wrap up the series on that topic, there are some really important things about it. They don't tend to influence a single moment in time. This is the important consideration around this kind of stuff. We're really talking about things that become habit of mind type of stuff, more than just, you know, good quick tips. However, every now and then, they're pretty helpful in the moment too. So thanks, Connor.
Yeah, and congratulations again on that PR.
Speaking of things that you all, as listeners, sometimes say to us, in particular, shout out to Brandon because he's been the one who has continued to keep this front of mind. Brandon has been fascinated by arm carriage of runners, and he keeps mentioning things to me after like the Olympic trials and then after Boston, or no, actually not specifically after Boston, but some of the more recent races. And in the topic of reflection, it just makes me think about there was this old joke in college. We heard a coach once at the track shouting to his athletes in the middle of their races. The phrase he kept using is forearm angles. He kept saying, not anything else, just saying those two words, forearm angles. And he would yell it like aggressively, like that meant something. And we just joked about it endlessly because that's not probably something that really computes as motivation to a runner. You know, it's a reminder, obviously some kind of cue, having something to do, we hope, with what the coach was working on with the athletes.
Yeah, well, we asked, Hodge said that he was telling him to drop his arms to have better forearm angles, but that's not the best way to say it. The better thing to say
maybe.
Would be
we actually don't know what that coach meant by it, but
relax your arms.
Right, perhaps that. However, the point is there are studies around this topic, and as Brandon has been in pursuit of finding, there are some takeaways, but They're the kind of takeaways that don't tend to influence anyone's change in action. And so it's funny because Brandon keeps using the phrase, he's talking about chicken wings. He's like, all the pro runners, they've all got the chicken wings, where basically their hands are high and their elbows stay in fairly close. And then there's just not a lot of movement. Their shoulders move, but their arms and their hands don't necessarily change much. And then you compare that with when you start to look at just a larger spectrum of runners, like just everybody, then you get tons of variations in what people are doing with their arms. And it's just a little bit like infinite. You can do anything with your arms and fit in a race. And the point here is there are some considerations, like things you shouldn't do with your arms because they're wasting energy or taking up energy. In principle, they have studied this, but they continue to study things like sprint speed. And what no one really has spent much time trying to study is the energy cost over long periods of time of different kinds of arm carriage. And that's the part where I think if we were to judge, why is it that you see when you look at the elite level of running, they do tend to all have about the same arm carriage. Why is that? Probably because over time, when you just run that much and you're running that much at a hard effort, your body tends to aspire toward greater efficiency. We talked about this with a number of others over the years, where you get a certain degree of running economy benefit by just running more, right? Like your body just kind of gets a little bit better at it. Now, there's also bad habits that we should avoid and work on. And so, you know, those don't just miraculously disappear because we're running more. And at the same time, arm carriage, you tend to see over time, certain things happen. And Ryan Hall commented recently, which was another one of the comments that Brandon brought my attention to. Ryan Hall recently was commenting about how he, because this was a huge criticism about him back in the day, he had this really weird arm carriage versus most of the others around him at the professional level. His arms were very low, like really low, down by his hips most of the time. And then he actually specifically said it was on purpose because he always thought that he was helping himself as a runner by having his arms pushing forward more as he was running. And so he would always have his arms super low and be like thinking about like almost like punching out with his arms, which is why it produced this really kind of strange arm carriage. Since then, he has said, well, basically it was a little bit less efficient what he was doing, and advising his past self, he would have advised just a little bit more high and relaxed arm carriage.
Well, I was always told that you were supposed to have them lower as well.
Not by your hips.
Like, right, yeah, like here.
No.
Yeah.
That's way lower than what you're talking about.
Like a potato chip between your fingers, yep. Like a little jelly bean between your fingers. You relax your hands and arms. But here's the point. Here's the point that I have. Because I
probably
do
different than my point. Go ahead.
So, this is the stuff that I also nerd out about. But a lot of pros even have this problem, and they would tell you this, is that they have too much tension in their shoulders, and that's why they hike their arms up. And it's actually not good or efficient, but when you're trying to run fast, sometimes you carry tension up higher, and then they end up having tight shoulders. I've talked to runners, professional runners, that have sore, tight shoulders and neck after running because they're clenching. And that's not good. We want to try to relax that and shake out your arms, not have them super high, because that usually is indication that they're running tense. So another tip would be like opening your hands up. That can help you not hold as much tension in your arms. But I do think in general, just because all the pros are doing that higher one, it's because they're running more tense, they're racing. But a lot of them could benefit from relaxing their shoulders a bit.
So that's not actually at all what I'm talking about. Their shoulders are relaxed if they're doing it right. But you can see the difference. You can see a runner who's got a tense shoulder that looks very different. The point is, how much are my arms moving? And if they're moving too much, it's less efficient. And if they're moving too little, maybe it's because I'm too uptight or something. But insofar as what do we take away from this, there are things that people do with their arms that need to be improved upon. But for the most part, if there's anything consistent in all the research, it is that you really shouldn't try to coerce an arm carriage that feels unnatural. And so you get to the point of like, what is a relaxed, natural feeling arm carriage? And unless I'm doing some absurd things with my arms, I should probably do whatever feels normal when I'm relaxed.
It can be beneficial towards the end of a race to pump your arms a little bit more, because that does help key some of your near muscularity for your legs as well, to lift your knee higher. So when you hear track coaches, especially like in the end of a 2 mile or mile, and they say to pump your arms, it actually does help your brain lift your knees and your heels better. So I can't say that you can do that for a whole marathon. Don't do that for a whole marathon. But like towards the end and you're having a hard time driving your knee, it can help to pump your arms a bit.
There you go. Everything you didn't think you needed to know about arms. You've just known. Speaking of knowing things, let's get on now to your questions. Always glad for your questions. Always remember to ask them by sending an email to questions@a2zrunning.com. Like this one from Addison. In fact, Addison has sent a question in earlier this season, and we're featuring another one because, one, it's always fun to engage with the utes of the sport, and Addison, being a high school runner, has lots of great questions that we don't always think about all the time, and so it's great to be able to infuse some additional perspective. But also, this one is actually a really important question that we probably have never really talked about much on A to Z Running, and so I thought, let's get into this for a minute. So I'm going to read the question, and then Andy's going to start us off with some really important takeaways here. From Addison, my coach always tells us to do about 2 miles cool down. He's talking about like an easy jog after workouts and races, no matter what events we run. This is only the distance team, of course, so we're not talking about the sprinters. They do things a little differently. But here's the example. It was raining at the time, and I was wondering, what's the point of doing the cool-down runs after an event? I'm already cold because it's raining. How does this help improve performance for the next race, if at all? I still have at least a month of racing remaining, and sometimes I feel good during my cool-downs, and sometimes I feel completely exhausted. Do they prevent injuries or something like that, or why do we have them at all? So thank you for asking, Addison.
Yes, thanks for asking. So your cool down is going to help move your blood. Blood that needs blood to be cleaned up a bit. So when you do your cool down, you're going to be recovering faster, for sure, hands down. So you're going to feel better, especially if you get on a bus afterwards. You don't want to be sitting after a hard effort and letting your blood pool. Moving your body is the best way to begin the recovery process. So, Zach, you found a study about this?
Well, not just one in particular. There's actually a lot of studying around cool down running. So this is one of those, like, since the dawn of modern distance training, people have been doing cool down runs.
Since they stopped wearing jeans during the marathon.
Yeah, maybe we'll call that the benchmark. Since they stopped wearing jeans and drinking hard spirits for aid stations. But as it were, much of the time people have not asked why they should do these. They just do them because it just that's what everyone does. And so, as you might guess, people have tried to study this more closely to try to figure out, you know, some coaches just make claims like, well, you do this because of this, whether or not that is reinforced in any sense. And what we have found as we've looked through these various studies is that most of the claims that coaches make are at least kind of true. Not always as substantially
true. Zach says most coaches because he's known a lot of good coaches, but I know that there are some crazy not great recommendations out there too.
Sure. I'm just saying when a coach says go jog for a cool down after a workout, that's what I'm talking about.
Good recommendation.
Which pretty much every coach does at some point or another for distance runners. In any event, the studies are actually somewhat inconsistent though on a couple of the key points that we tend to, like the schema around distance running, the shared schema, tend to believe. And so in particular, the recovery factor, it seems to be the case that it's not a major factor, except that it will have a major difference depending on what other things you're doing or not doing. And so to Andy's point, movement helps blood flow, and blood flow, especially near the hard effort stimulus, so like within the next hour or so, blood flow is going to speed recovery and it's going to reduce soreness. And both of those have been proven every single time they've studied this, right? But you can achieve that blood flow in a lot of different ways. It does not necessarily have to be a cool down jog. And that's where you get some of this contention that tends to arise. People will be like, it's a waste. It's junk miles. It's worthless, all this kind of stuff. None of that's true. It's not a waste. It's not junk miles because you're using it to help recover. And that's
to get rid of the junk.
Right. But the point is, if you weren't to jog a cool down, you could get away with all of the benefits in other ways, but you have to do some of those other things. And getting on the bus and riding home and then, you know, going and eating dinner and then sleeping or doing homework or whatever you got to do the rest of the evening, none of those things help your body recover well like movement. So that's one, but we're not done yet.
Right. As a young athlete, especially, you're stimulating your musculoskeletal growth. So you're actually continuing to gain fitness if you do your cool down, because you're adding to the time and the pounding that's going to strengthen your bones, joints, and ligaments, as well as build those capillaries that you want delivering the oxygen to your muscles.
Certainly that. Now, you said, Addison, that sometimes you feel totally exhausted on the cool down. There's always a line somewhere in the sand when these things are no longer helping us. But fatigue by itself is not necessarily a reason not to do it, because that adds a layer of forcing stimulation in the midst of fatigue. And it's not a major stimulation. You know, you're not doing a hard effort here. Another case can be made at times about doing additional hard efforts after these kinds of things, but we're not talking about that now. And so in this instance, yes, you're going to get some kind of benefit, especially, which is almost always the case for younger runners, especially because you tend to be racing quite a bit. And so this helps to add to the overall stimulus. And that's where you're going to get a lot of people to argue with you and say, no, it's just junk. It's not really helping. And I guess they would be right if you like did a workout and then an hour later you went and jogged for 10 minutes and that was it. And then, so I guess they're kind of right that that's not really helping much. But in the old wisdom of Arthur Lydiard, he made the case that even 5 or 10 minutes of jogging is still a musculoskeletal stimulus, which he's right, by the way, without doing any of the research, because he didn't have access to any of the research at the time. And so in principle, even if it's a small stimulus, it's a positive stimulus. And we don't ever chagrin, that's the wrong word. We don't ever shy away from value when it can especially be so easily achieved as a simple jog. And finally, our last point here, we do very much see the value here, Addison, that is not the physiological, but the other things. And for the team component, most of the time after races and workouts, we're doing these kinds of jogs together, especially when most of us are not actually running the entirety of the hard effort together. We're not all at the same exact level. And so you're a little ahead of me, I'm a little ahead of someone else, all that kind of stuff. So then the cool down is like this coming together time. And that is a team morale, community boosting, like all that kind of stuff. It's good. And we should not shy away from the good that such a time can achieve. And further still, when we're using that time to chat about the races and to, you know, like a little bit of patting each other on the back, nice job, all that kind of stuff, some reflection, here's what I did, I made this big mistake at this point in the race, I should have moved and I didn't. Those things are one of the most valuable things in growing us as an athlete in the sport. And for most adult runners, we just don't do that. And it's kind of a bummer. Missed opportunity. Like, you finish a race, you go to the local 5K or something, grab the nearest 4 or 5 people at the finish line and say, hey, let's go jog a mile together. And then just talk about the race. It's a wonderful thing.
I've done this before.
Andy does that way more than Zach.
Cool downs with strangers. Mm-hmm.
I have. That sounds like a podcast. Cool downs with strangers.
Yeah.
She has. And it's good. So we highly encourage it.
So good in all the ways, I guess.
Good in all the ways. Yeah. There you go, Addison. So now, if you have at any point in time thought, I hate these cooldowns my coach is making me do, stop it. And instead enjoy them, because there's much good to be achieved. And even if some of the studies suggest it's not really doing anything major for you physiologically all the time,
but
it's good in other ways.
Reducing soreness
anyway.
And helping with recovery,
right.
Is very valuable, especially if you are racing so much. Well, thank you for your question, Addison.
Absolutely that. And for anyone else, if you got them, ask them by sending an email to email to questions@a2zrunning.com. And with that, let's now get on to our main topic. Quick recap here. We've been talking about Wise Decisions, in particular, the book. And in that work, we've been trying to break down what it looks like to build a kind of practice of wise decision making. And that's an interesting thought, right? And so I said at the very beginning, I think it's kind of a bold claim by the authors to suggest wisdom is a sure thing in their work. But at the same token, it's an interesting reflection when we think about, okay, decision making in general. Why am I making decisions the way I'm making them, and what are some things I can do to improve upon that? As runners, we tend to be our own worst enemies in our sport, both in terms of day-to-day training and preparing our bodies, as well as when it comes to race day and race execution itself. And so if we can benefit from thinking about our decision-making, and especially if we can benefit in ways that, as we like to say here at A to Z Running, we're not just talking about being a better runner, but also just, you know, thriving in life. And we think that these things are connected. And so this is the kind of content that tends to examine the whole picture. And so we talked about energy and how it's limited and how making decisions costs energy. And then following through with those decisions costs even more energy. And then we talked about some of the things that we do when we lie to ourselves and how our brains tend to be wired to want to help us achieve the thing we want, even in deceptive ways internally. And then what we really want to get to with all of this is, what are some of the kind of the practical things that help me form habits of mind around these sound considerations? And that's where we're going to end today, by looking at three key topics that I think we will all find especially pertinent and relevant to life as well as running, which is always a good combination. Those three things are energy, emotion, and stress. Did I introduce it well?
I mean, those words, every time I hear those words, I like have a million things I want to say about it. So I'm glad that there are categories and a structure to this to help us talk through this really important topic, because it's a good one.
We have been saying since the dawn of A to Z Running that the most important thing in terms of thriving is that energy piece, in terms of, as a person, how am I channeling my energy and where am I directing it? And it just so happens to be that that's one of the key focal points of this book, which I didn't know, by the way, until after I started looking into it. That wasn't one of the things that attracted me to it. But when I started reading this section in particular, and I was like, oh my goodness, they're just saying the things that, in better ways than I have over the years. I don't know about Andy, she says things in really good ways. But they're saying all the things, and then they're substantiating it in ways we didn't always or haven't always. And so we wanted to bring this to your attention a bit and just talk through how these three areas then are also connected. So starting with energy in particular, this really was kind of the beginning of the whole thing, and it took us until the third week looking at the topic to really dive further into it, because we had to set the stage with some of those other things. But what we're talking about with energy is this kind of combined consideration of, okay, so we have energy can be positive or negative, and it can be high or low, and things can cost energy and things can give energy. And so, you know, things can charge us up, things can drain us, all this kind of stuff. And when it comes to directing our energy, the authors have a few things to say about this. In particular, one of them, the first of them here, is that there's like this sense of we have a quality component to it, we have a quantity component to it, a focus and an intensity component, which I think is really interesting to think about. Like, it's not the same thing to devote a substantial amount of energy to something in ways that are not likely to achieve the goal, right? So this, the example they give is like, if you want to have stronger biceps, go to the gym, right? And, you know, and do stuff. But what if you go to the gym and then just do a lot of leg work? Well, you're not going to get much stronger biceps. That's a quality energy problem, right? Not a problem with quantity. You're doing it for hours and hours maybe, but not going to achieve that end. We talk about that so much in running, which is the idea of quality training implemented over time. When we first started to try to define what it means for a runner to be able to progress physiologically, we said, you know, is there basically like one statement that just kind of captures it? And it came down to that: quality training implemented consistently over time. And that's just our refrain now. We just say that constantly. But that quality piece was really important, because there are things we can do as runners that are not only not necessarily going to help us, but may in fact cause us problems. We should avoid them, which is where the quality matters.
And quality doesn't mean quality miles that people say a lot. They use the term quality miles.
And they're really just talking about running hard.
Running hard. But it is doing, getting all the pieces to the puzzle that you need in order to have quality training, which some of that is quality miles that people say. I just wanted to differentiate between that language, because I know that's something that a lot of people say. They say quality miles, but we're talking about like the full pizza, not just a slice of it.
Yeah, right. And the things that connect most clearly and closely with the desired outcomes. That's when you talk about quality. That's a key. Now, as the authors continue to examine this, I thought it was a fascinating concept. We're not going to dwell on it too long, except for that it's a nice kind of life reminder in general. They were talking about this idea of full engagement, where like all of your energy capacity is directed toward. And that's where they said if you have those four areas, quality, quantity, focus, and intensity, and all of it is channeled toward this thing, they call that like full and best energy investment, and otherwise, in other words, full engagement. But their claim about full engagement, which I think is actually kind of interesting, I'm going to just read the quote here from page 104 for those who are following along. Showing up fully engaged is the greatest gift we can give to others. It's the greatest gift we have to give to the world because of its direct connection to expanded growth. In other words, when we take energy, which they would define as well as life, energy and life or life energy, when we take that from our body and invest it elsewhere, we give life and the potential for growth to whomever or whatever we've chosen to give our energy. Now that is deep. That is deep and rich. But in principle, the idea is we are giving a gift to others or to the world or to a person by being fully engaged with that person in some capacity. However, there's an additional filter here, which is really interesting, and that is that energy isn't always positive. And so fully engaged could be a bad thing also if we're directing negative energy and not just positive energy. But in principle, they're talking about positive energy when they say it that way.
When we have this discussion talking about being engaged, I really like to bring up the different usages of our energy on our runs and what occupies us when we are doing our training. And sometimes it's really good to utilize a run to let our minds think about all the things of the day and process. It's a really good time to allow us to do that. I would not call that fully engaged running. And I don't think every day needs to have fully engaged running, but I do think that there should be some days that are fully engaged running if you plan to have a race that you want to stay fully engaged. Because it does take practice of giving that energy during your race that you definitely want to do in practice too.
Yeah. And one of the interesting side components of this is that when in a social setting, it's easier to be fully engaged in one sense, because you have something else that's drawing you in. And when it's a person, it feels rude to not be fully engaged with them. And so like there's that, but at the same token, not being fully engaged with a person tends to cause problems. Like people feel it and they don't like it. And so that's the example of, you know, you're sitting at dinner with someone and you're looking at your phone routinely. We've all seen the memes. They're everywhere. And nobody really likes that feeling of I'm here present with someone, but they are not here present with me. Or in other words, I'm fully engaged, but the other person's not. So it's unbalanced. But that's what's beautiful about running, and especially running with other people, is because it creates this natural opportunity where it's kind of hard not to be fully engaged. Unless you run with other people with headphones in and you're like listening to other stuff. Apparently people do that.
I've seen it a lot lately, but that's a whole nother topic.
That is. I don't know. I don't understand. But anyway, that aside, otherwise we're usually fully engaged when we're running with other people because there's nothing else to do except be there with each other doing the thing because we're running. I would say, to Andy's point, I like the idea that it's not a bad practice to look for opportunities to deliberately be fully engaged with our sport, because it benefits us in the sport, but also it's kind of a healthy way to engage, check out of some things as a kind of rest period and into something else. We talked about that with one of the recent TED Talks. We had heard about this idea of, like, you kind of check out of your problems when you go for a run, and it gives you a chance to engage with them at a different level, and then you can check back in. Anyway.
My coach Hodge used to say, Andy, you think about so many things. When you come to practice, just come and run and think about running.
How did that work for you?
It actually was great.
Yeah, I believe it.
So that's actually something I've taken with me. And there are times that I do use running. Like I mentioned, I think it's healthy to use running to process and use running for relationship and use running in all these ways to have it serve us, because we're still getting some physiological benefits. But when we're talking about learning how to channel our energy and we want, like I said, to be engaged in the run, in the race, in the best way we can to discover our potential, we do need to practice going into a run and investing our mind and our energy towards the sport.
Yeah. An example of in practice is things like, you know, personally, when I'm on easy runs, I'll often listen to podcasts and audiobooks a lot of the time. When I'm doing hard efforts, nothing in my ears, as few distractions as possible. And even especially so when I'm doing something that's more like repeats or intervals of some kind, then I'm even more in the harder effort periods, not letting my mind wander, but dialing in the thinking around just the thing that I'm doing. One of the reasons I do that is because I feel better. My body responds very directly to whether I am attentive to what I'm doing in the moment. And so I tried to do, I don't remember what it was, a fartlek. I was trying to do a hard effort combination fartlek a week or two ago, and I needed to have my phone on me. I don't recall exactly why, but I needed to. And so then I thought, since it's on me, I might as well like put in the headphones and listen to my audiobook that I was listening to at the time. And it was like the worst fartlek I've done in weeks, if not years. I just felt terrible off. I couldn't quite like dial it in, and I kept like fading in and out of like I was running a hard effort, and then I kind of realized, I'm not quite going very hard anymore because I wasn't focused. It was amazing. Well, anyway, you get the point. We've belabored it some.
But I do think that it ties in some of those other pieces that we've talked about too, because one of the words is focus here. So if we're able to focus our energy while we're running and direct it to being able to stay positive and have the positive energy versus the negative energy, then we're going to run substantially better. But then also we had talked about habits. So we're talking about in training, practicing our focus and using our energy in a direct way to running as well. So all these pieces tie in, and the more you do it, habits cost you less energy. It's all coming together here, right? So then when we're able to direct it, it's not going to feel as laborious as if we only occasionally run without earbuds in or run without distractions.
Yeah. And that comes back to decisions cost energy, and following through with decisions cost even more energy. But when something becomes a habit, it's no longer really truly a decision anymore. It's automated. And we want to automate as many good things as possible in life. Good decisions as possible, I would say, which now that I think about it is not really something that the authors talk a lot about here, but you'll read this in many other works. It's just in principle, this idea of automating good habits. Anyway, we'll come back to that. So I just wanted to mention one more thing here about energy in particular, two layers, I guess. The one is that the authors address how there's, as I mentioned earlier, there's positive and negative energy, and then there's high and low levels of intensity, and it creates a quadrant, right, with four areas. And high positive energy is a great place to be. We're productive, we're motivated, we're inspired. That's wonderful. Low positive energy is not bad. You know, it's restful, serene, it's peaceful, and mellow, but it's all good. High negative energy is like the worst place to be to make decisions. So that's where we're like angry or fearful, or, you know, some of these like heavy negative emotions, defensive and resentful. So the authors specifically say that we need to be better at, we've talked about reflective consciousness as we've been addressing this work. They use that phrase a lot. In our reflective consciousness, we need to be aware of when we are in a high negative state of energy, because we're going to make bad decisions most of the time. And we should try not to make important decisions during that, you know, come out of it first before we do. So they talk about postponing or delaying decision making. In conflict with other people, that's actually some really good interpersonal conflict advice, which is the idea of, we're clearly upset and heated right now. We should stop trying to solve whatever problem is immediately before us, calm down a bit, and then come back to it. And if you're anything like me, then really that's just an excuse to try not to come back to it at all, so you don't have to address it anymore. Why are you nodding your head? No, don't answer that. Okay, all right, fine. You can answer that if you... No?
I'm just smiling because, yeah, we've gone through this because I'm high energy, high positive energy, and then high negative energy at times. And so Zach has always wanted to... Like he says, like it's wise to step away when you're heated and come back to a conversation. But that would frustrate me sometimes because I felt like he was just kind of disappearing. But obviously he's right about needing to step away. So that was really good for me in my life, that because I really hate the feeling of things not being resolved. That really bothers me. So I had to work on that.
You say that in the past tense.
I mean, I'm getting better with it.
All right. I got you. Well, as it were, if you spend too much time in high negative states of energy, we tend to crash at some point. And the crash is also really bad. Like low negative energy is not great either. And so the authors specify this practice they call voluntary recovery. I'm clearly in a high negative energy state. I need to find a way to rest, to recover. And how can I get into a low positive state of energy? And that has a lot to do with, you know, trying to recognize what's causing this for me, which arguably is, if you're in a high negative state of energy, you're more likely to make bad decisions, which in my mind means you're also, it's a catch 22. You're also more likely to make bad decisions about your decision making. So while their advice is great, it's going to be really hard to turn that into consistent positive practice. More than anything, I think that the authors continue to remind us, and this is one of my key reflections here, that being in a high negative state of energy is generally a symptom of some other thing. There's something else that is off in enough of a way that it's putting me in that state. And that's where I just go back to the author's original comments that in order for us to make wise decisions, fundamentally, we need to be healthy. And that should be like the goal. We should aspire toward being healthy. And they talk about the four domains. We need to be mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually healthy. And if we're unhealthy in any of those four domains, then chances are we're not going to be making good decisions. Hmm. So let's talk about emotions.
Wow. I never thought I'd hear you say that.
I don't mean my emotions. Oh. I mean, at an idea level, emotions. I have no problem talking about someone else's emotions. So anyway, emotional intelligence, which is the ability to recognize my emotions, identify and respond appropriately. Emotional intelligence, as the authors discuss here, really is somewhat of a new observation in the fields of physiology, psychology, and sociology. And yet, it's a really important consideration in that when we are generally in a place of emotional health, there's a kind of shared sense of knowing what I'm feeling and knowing how I ought or ought not to respond according to that. And so it's a good consideration, you know, where that is not the case, I tend to struggle with those negative, high negative energies. So in any event, that being kind of the, you know, the obvious statement of the episode here, it's good to be aware of our emotions. Also, I should note that the authors spend a lot of time talking about how the interchange between our brains and where emotions are happening, and then how they are expressed, and then how they influence physiology, which happens to be a very consistently studied thing. Our emotional states have physiological effects, and it's not necessarily a cause effect. Like, sometimes the physiological effects are a result of the brain chemistry that emotion is causing. So it's not like because I am feeling a certain way, it's because the things that do things in my head, like the hormones and the neurons and the all that stuff, when they do certain things, other things in my body happen as a result in order to demonstrate some physiological process. But that's interesting. But what does it look like to talk practically here? And really, it just goes back to, I need to be able to, just like with the energy thing, I need to be able to recognize when I'm in an emotional state that is not as productive for good decision making, and try to then respond better. And we'll come to the how to respond better in a moment, because that relates closely with the last one. But Andy and I wanted to take a brief moment here to illustrate our own challenges with this particular topic, because negative emotions influence decision making for everybody, but we all tend to experience them very differently, like certain negative emotions more than others, and doing things as a response to those. So, for instance, with Zach, I actually am going to talk about my emotions.
Good job.
But only briefly.
I support you.
So things like frustration or a feeling of a lack of control, or a sense of failure, things like that. When I feel those things, I tend to not make good decisions or not treat people super well. For example, when Andy reminds me, when I wrote the note to myself, I wrote the word nag, but that's probably not a very nice thing to say. Andy's not a nag. All the time. So when she reminds me about something that I know I have missed or messed up, and she reminds me repeatedly sometimes, I get very defensive and biting and snide and sarcastic and all of those things. And it can be entirely innocent and harmless, like literally can be. It's not like Andy's causing problems on purpose here, almost never. But what ends up happening is it becomes a problem because I already feel a sense of failure because I messed it up or I missed it or I forgot it or something like that. And so then I get defensive. And I would say then what's happening there is I have a very poor perspective, because with just simply applying a few filters before I start reacting at all, I could respond much, much better. We're going to talk about what those filters might be here. That's kind of our big, huge takeaway in a bit. But you can see in something so simple as that, I know I'm going to make a bad decision when I'm feeling defensive or frustrated. I just know it. And so if I could just stop myself from saying anything for like 10 seconds and just let that defensiveness detach just a little bit, I am far more likely to make a better choice.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah.
Go ahead, Andy. That's enough.
Okay. So my fear of failure, when I have that emotion, I lack confidence and I concede to other people's dominance. And so how does that affect my decisions? Like, what's an example of that? Well, sometimes like I don't go for things. Like I don't consider myself for maybe something at work, or maybe I don't consider myself for a race opportunity or to put my name in the ring for like an elite bib or something like that.
Andy always says, she always does it. She's like, I don't want to do that because I might not be ready, or I might not be as good as, you know, fill in the blank. And I'm always like, who cares? Just do it and see how it ends up.
Yeah. So the fear of failure causes me to make decisions, which are usually indecisions. Like I don't end up doing things that I've thought about or dreams that I've maybe had or considered, I don't do it because I am afraid to fail. Worry keeps me from enjoying things because I stress about the details. And what that looks like for decisions is I keep doing and doing and going instead of stopping and embracing like what's happening in like the sweet moments of life. And
would you say that the doing and doing is productive doing and doing?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes it is.
Like baking bread?
Yeah, I do that when I get
stressed. It is productive because we all like the bread. But baking the bread doesn't address the problem at hand either, though.
Right.
Right.
So worry can keep me from enjoying things sometimes. Mm. And I make decisions about how to spend my time differently. Yeah. And then the feeling of defeat, which I have two examples of this. When I am running a lot and I'm in races and things, like sometimes like if someone will pass me in a race and I'm feeling really bad, like I slow down instead of like latch on because my emotion is the feeling of defeat. And then my body follows, and we've talked about this a lot, but like, you know, my head will come down a little bit and then my form's not as good. And then I end up having a worse race because I have this feel, this emotion of defeat that ends up changing my posture and my decisions. Mm. So that's one example of a feeling of defeat. Another one is like lately, which is super unusual for me. I've just had this super long road since my last marathon, which was in 2020. I've had a long road of surgeries and injuries. I've been making decisions to run less and exercise less because I'm so far away from where I want to be. So that feeling of defeat of like, I'm not where I want to be, keeps me from making good decisions that in the long run will make me happier, like getting into running and being more with my friends and doing this thing that I enjoy that helps me decompress. So the feeling of defeat, I make poor decisions like not being as invested in running as an example.
Honest moments with Andy.
Yes. I try to do that.
So we're going to solve all these problems in just a moment. But before we do, we need to address the last of the three key topics here, which is stress. And we understand stress is necessary for growth. The authors specify that. But also, chronic stress is a problem. And so stress plus recovery, periods of recovery, is the recipe for growth. That's how our physiology works. That's how our brain works. Our brain grows in the same sense that our body grows. And arguably, that's how, you know, all the areas, emotional and spiritual health, and respond in a similar sense. We do things to stress an area, and then we recover in order to grow it. So the key here then is it's not the stressful event that is the problem. While that is the case in terms of the catalyst, the authors specify, and I think I would agree personally, interested if you do as well, Andy, that really the stressful event is not the issue. It is my perception of the event and how I respond to it, which they specify is the story that I'm telling myself about the thing and or myself. And so that's where they get into all these examples of you can have the same exact experience happen to 100 people and they will all evaluate differently how positive or negative or stressful or not stressful it was. And that, of course, we see that time and time again. A good example is COVID. And the authors brought this up, which I thought I was kind of surprised that they did because I wasn't sure what point they were making until they said their point was that they feel like, as in general, societally, that we are better able to handle a situation like that now in the future, having gone through that. However, if you start to ask at an individual level people about the significance of something like that, like COVID, you're going to get way different responses from people. And you'll hear some people talk about how that was like the darkest days, the worst time ever. And you'll have other people say, yeah, it was not great. And that's kind of it. And it's like, how can that be? Well, so much of it has to do with the combination of what we're telling ourselves, the story in our minds, as well as the nature of the degree of chronic stress experiences. So where that stress occurs relative to other stresses, as well as my responses. So if those are the two ways that we can consider this, let's just briefly talk about, okay, so we know that's the case, but what can we do about this? We're experiencing a thing that is stressful. What can we do about that? And then we'll zoom all the way out and talk about kind of the big solutions here. So there are three that they gave, which are just really great. The first is stay connected to others. And we know this to be true. When we are in difficult moments, other people and the connections to other people are helpful in many different kinds of ways, but that's good advice. Seek perspective in the storm, which is also has to do with other people. You can do this yourself, but it's very, very hard to create multiple perspectives in my own mind about something. It's much easier to have other people around me give additional perspectives. And then the last one was just taking action on things you can control and just letting the rest go, the things you can't control. And as soon as Andy and I were looking at this, what did you say, Andy? You're like, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, it sounds like the recovery program prayer, which is, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, which I have said thousands and thousands of times. I've said that prayer because that is it, right? Because we worry about things. We give all this energy to things that we cannot control, things that are futile. We're a little hamster on a wheel running, give it this energy and going nowhere with it because it's not something that we can control. So once we're able to then invest in the things that we can control, it is so much more satisfactory. It is so much more life-giving when we're able to invest our energy, emotion, and stress into places that we can see growth.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. The 12-step program, however many years ago when it first began, they were onto something with that. And the authors here don't seem to directly connect the dots, but they're giving the exact same advice. And even in the situations you talk about, and it's in those programs, but it's in many other contexts, the idea of like just sitting down with people who also have similar experiences and just talking about those experiences, that's the additional perspective thing, right?
Or people who have had different experiences who are able to share with you how they went through a similar event entirely differently. That has been amazing for me.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
I've talked to people that are more like Zach, and so then they'll share with me like experiences that they have, and I'm like, oh, that helps me understand Zach more because he would probably respond similarly. So it's like, It's cool. I think it's helpful because we can learn about each other. We're not all the same. So it's really good for us to have different voices that are speaking into us.
So with all of this in mind, as we've been talking through now these different concepts, there's essentially a two-layer approach here that these authors are recommending throughout the entire work. And just to help us address, so what do we do about these things that makes a difference? The first is remembering those four domains of health, and when anything is amiss there, it's going to cause other issues. And so being able to just routinely examine myself and my physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health, and where are those things and what could I potentially do to improve upon an area that might be weak or amiss or awry, that's key. Now, the layer that makes the biggest difference in the moment, in a critical moment, is this what they call the seven lens approach, which we're just going to briefly note. And we've talked about this a bit already. Now we're just kind of bringing it all together. But I'm in the midst of a high negative energy state, or I'm experiencing these bad emotions, or I'm under a ton of stress and my story I'm telling myself is bad. This can be like, you know, I'm in the middle of a race, right? I'm in the middle of a race and I'm having these experiences, or I'm in the middle of a fight with some person and I'm having these experiences. And they say, okay, we got to go through the seven lenses. And the first is the best self, which is like the what can I do for others? If I am my best self in this moment, what does that mean I'm doing? And so as a runner, a lot of times that's like, you know, I if I'm my best self, then what choice am I making right now that leads me toward my goals, right? We'll come back to that in a moment. But the next layer is his best moral self, which is this idea of like, there's a right thing to do. And when there is a right thing to do, I should pursue it because it's going to be much better for me in my own desires and my own health, but also the thing I'm doing by pursuing what is right and good. And then there's this life purpose sense, which is kind of the like doing good things side of things in general, like do good. What's the quote? Do good and avoid evil. It's pretty straightforward, but hard to do. And then there's the tombstone legacy idea, which is like, how am I going to be remembered? What am I leaving behind? And I think that's a nice little perspective here, which is just they go through this whole exercise in the book, which is like, you know, actually write your caption for your tombstone to yourself, you know, in your own mind.
I just think it's so funny how you said, nice little idea, talking about death.
Not talking about death, talking about legacy.
Yes.
Death is inevitable.
I know.
And so it's not so much
the thing. This
isn't
a little idea. This is a big idea. Yeah. And it's one that is worth thinking about for sure. Yeah.
Next up here is the core values and beliefs one, which we were mentioning a fair bit more last week. But that's the, you know, what do I hold dear or what is of value? And how does that then influence the decisions I'm making right now? And then the personal credo, which is the like my guiding principle and or guiding statement, if I have one. They have exercises you can go through to create one if you don't. And then there's this life mission or ultimate life mission sense of like, how am I making a difference in the world? And by the certain things that I'm doing broadly, but how does this moment connect to that broader life mission? So you can see that's really big thinking stuff. Their point is by being routine with those kinds of perspectives that we do actually automate that kind of a habit.
And this is all about, remember, making decisions, making wise decisions. And so if we want to make decisions that we are proud of, then we have to align them with all of these really important things in our lives. And so as we do think about it, as it's called lenses, right? As we look through situations with these lenses, it can help us in turn to make action in life that leads us on the path that we've been pursuing.
And if we can do that, if we can leverage those kinds of things, then what the point there is, then we're going to be telling ourselves a better story about the moment, about ourselves, about those people around us. And that's the inner voice side of it. We're conditioning our inner voice to be better. And their argument here is that in practice, where we do this, we become wiser decision makers, fundamentally, in any area, in all areas. And I think, one, at the very beginning, at the outset, we said they're making a bold claim here. I do not see how they are wrong in that claim. That if we were to put into practice these recommendations, insofar as they look differently for different people, but we're trying to address this concept here, if we do that, I think that that produces a wiser person than if we don't. And as an athlete, as I pursue my goals, it also helps me keep the right balance and perspective.
And the reason this all ties in is not only the decisions we make when we're running or in a race, but because we're talking about having a thriving life and we think we can get the most out of our training and we can enjoy all of our sport more if we're able to have it woven in a healthy way to our lives. And this kind of conversation can help benefit that.
Right on. So now that we have both solved all your problems and made you wiser in only a single podcast episode, I guess all three if you take the whole topic into account, I think we can let the topic now rest a bit because we have a really exciting interview for next week, which we'll share more about.
It's with Dakota Lindworm.
Ha, you gave it away.
I'm so excited.
That's going to be great. But keep all these things in mind. And then let us know, as you're chewing on them, how these things play out for you. Because that, of course, is of great interest to us. Whether this stuff is helpful in your own ways. And with that, we're now ready to get on to the world of running.
We're going to kick things off like we normally do with some A to Z Runner shout-outs. It was a very exciting marathon Monday. We had Dan, Steph, Spencer, Pina, Hannah, Mark, Julie, and Kendra running the Boston Marathon. And special shout-out to Kendra, who ran a big PR. I think it was like 8 minutes.
Big time.
Yes. So very exciting for all of our A to Z runners, not only in that race, but all of the miles it took to get there. And for many of them, a long dream coming. So that's a really exciting thing to see that they got to experience the magic of the Monday Marathon.
Cool stuff. A monumental achievement and an opportunity to celebrate all the hard work, mm-hmm. for sure.
Now getting on to the news of the Boston Marathon and the pro race that went down. It was very exciting, as Zach said, nail biter.
I don't bite
my nails.
Right, but you're the one who actually said nail biter.
Oh, you wrote it.
But as it were, it was exciting. And we're going to try to break it down for you without spending too much time lost in the details, which are just so fun for us. We did watch it live, which if you were able to tune in, you had the opportunity to kind of see what amounted to a large portion of the race was not super nail biting. And then suddenly for both the men's and the women's races, the last several miles, everything was changing and it was really, really exciting. And here's on the men's side what that meant. So this one was touted as an opportunity for Evans Chebet of Kenya to go for the three-peat. He's a two-time defending champ at Boston, and he's here again. And that means, you know, there's kind of like a guy to beat, right? However, you also have a whole lot of world-class talent in this race. It was stacked. And among them include the likes of Cisse Lema of Ethiopia, who ran the number 4 all-time marathon just earlier this year. Actually, it was technically last year at Valencia. I don't remember when Valencia is. It's either in December or January. But anyway, he ran under 2:02, and now he's back. And that changes dynamics. You know, you've got someone who's like fiery and fresh. Not necessarily fresh, but he's been running great. And so at the same time, the stories abound. There's just so many different ones here, including in Lema's case, he's run Boston 3 times. 2 of them did not finish, like wasn't even able to finish. 1, when he finally finished, was 30th place. So not necessarily the first guy that everyone's going to be talking about. And yet he made the race all about him. And that's where things just get so interesting in these kinds of moments. We know Boston, it's a downhill first half. It's a very challenging, hilly second half, especially particularly a 5 or so mile stretch there. And so what usually happens in this race in the men's side and the women's side is you get a kind of like tactical affair where people are, you know, racing kind of casually, not casually, they're racing within themselves until you get to the hills and then really kind of bust out at some point around there. Well, Lema took a different approach and ran world record pace for the first half, or very nearly world record pace. This guy, after about the 5th mile, I think is about when he took off, after mile 5 or just before, he starts pressing and no one really goes with him at first because it was a pretty big move. It was kind of sudden, and you never know exactly how to interpret those moves. But by 10K, so it was like only a mile and change after he started his move, by 10K, he already had a 25-second lead. So in about a mile time. And this is a world-class field, okay? So 25 seconds in just about a mile. Well, 5K later, his lead had grown to a minute 21. And he ran a 14:07 5K to do it.
Not too shabby.
Early in a marathon, that is bad decision making in most cases. And you just got to wonder, was he doing it on purpose? Well, we know the answer to that now, but at the time, you don't really know for sure. And so then at 15K, he's like, okay, a minute 21 lead, what is this guy doing? Well, over the next 15K, between 15 and 30K, he grows that lead to almost 3 minutes, hits mile 20 with still just about a 3-minute lead and then starts to pay for it. And that's what I mean when I say it became a nail biter, because it was abundantly clear that every step he took from that point on, he was going backwards and they were coming up. And so when you have a guy go through the first half in almost world record pace and then start the hilliest section of just about any marathon in the majors, you gotta feel for the guy. What is he gonna do? So here's what happens. He starts losing chunks of time every mile. You can see it on the splits, but it's not quite enough. He's got almost a 3-minute lead. And so they're chopping into his lead. And you're just wondering, is he still going to hold? Well, he doesn't have to hold on that much, but if he totally falls apart, they'll catch him for sure because they're coming. But being a world-class marathoner as he is, he did not fall totally apart and held just enough to maintain what ended up being a 40-second win margin to take his first Boston Marathon victory. I believe that's his first marathon majors victory at all.
Wow.
And in so doing, probably sealed his ticket to the Olympics as well, as it's almost definitely
for
the case.
For Ethiopia, right?
Yes. Yep. Almost definitely the case that Ethiopia was looking at that as kind of a, you know, making sure that he's a good choice, because he did run fast earlier this year, but you know, you never know. So
there's a lot on the line with a world major like this, of course, but in an Olympic year when they're still deciding, there's like a preliminary list that a lot of countries make, and then you have to try to like become one of the three outstanding performers of your country. But also, I think part of the reason he went fast is because there's a $50,000 bonus for breaking Boston's course record. So I think that might have been a motivator for fast first half.
He wasn't anywhere close to it.
In the first half, he was.
Yeah, right. So I said his first half was the fastest anyone's ever run the first half in the course, 1 hour and 19 seconds. His second half was 1 hour, 5 minutes, and 58 seconds.
There's a discrepancy there.
5.5 minute positive split, which, by the way, if you start looking at the numbers, there are not many times, you can count them in a small quantity, how many times a marathoner has won a world marathon majors with a 5 or more minute positive split. You don't usually win when that happens. But when you've got a 3-minute lead and you lose all of that time in just the last 10K, well, maybe.
Very few people negative split at Boston, though. I think that a lot of people have some amount of positive splitting in the race. So
on the women's side, they did.
That's true. But we're going to get to that. We're going to talk about how rare of a race that was shortly.
So it ended up being Cisse Lima of Ethiopia for the championship, for the prize, rather. And then it was his countryman, Mohamed Issa, who took second. And by the way, he was also second in Tokyo a year ago as well. But his last mile was the fastest by far of anyone else. He ran 4:39 for his last mile, made up like 30 seconds on the previous second place guy, and not just made it up and then put time on him. So it ended up being Lema and Issa of Ethiopia for first and second, and very impressive finish from Issa. Evans Chebet, two-time defending champ, ended up third. Still respectable, especially when apparently he's actually been dealing with Achilles problems in this training cycle. And then Kenya took the next few places, and you've got John Carrier and Albert Carrier. And the first American was seventh place CJ Albertson. And we got to at least mention this because, one, it was a PR, personal best for Albertson in Boston. But also his previous personal best was set just in February, earlier this year at the Olympic Trials. So he ran 2:10 to 2:11 10 times in the last 4 years. And finally, here at Boston in this crazy year, ran 2:09:53 for his first time.
And I do want to mention this because I thought it might have been him, but it's not. There was a guy who went out really fast this year, like CJ did.
Yeah, that was the guy right behind him in eighth.
Yep. Yumemori of Japan went out really, really fast before he was overtaken in like
a
mile
miles, yeah,
or two later. But CJ ran a great race, and top 10 performance at a major is phenomenal. I do want to mention Zuhair Telbi of Morocco. He's been on this show before. He was 10th place.
Yeah, great work there too. All right, so on that note, the men's race was exciting. Oh, I did want to say just one other thing, because Albertson, it's just funny, but about a week ago, Albertson posted on Strava what he thought he would do at this race. He thought he'd run 209.51.
Ha!
He missed it by 2 seconds.
Price is right.
But it happened in a very different way than he predicted.
Okay.
Because he thought it was going to be a negative split or something close to, and it was not.
Okay.
Even so, he only missed it by 2 seconds. That's, well, I wonder what the over-under was on his prediction. Anyway, well done, men.
All right, it's time. I'm going to tell you how this women's race unfolded, which was drastically different than the men's. We didn't have a front runner for more than half of the race.
20 miles.
In fact, it was quite the opposite. We had a crowd. We had nearly 20 women together at almost, it was like 19 and change miles. That's a lot of women.
It's a huge pack.
It is. And there were 12 women still in the lead pack at 35K, which is 21.75 miles. That is like a lot of women. 12 in the lead pack with not much to go. It was mile 23 and 24 that we had women in the lead group. Sharon Ladoki, Helen O'Beery, Edna Kiplagat, and Worknish Edessa. So there's only 4 women then in mile 23, and that's because they ratcheted it down to their first sub-5 mile.
Okay? You keep saying they. There's one person responsible for what
was
happening.
Helen O'Beery was ratcheting it down, okay? She was ratcheting it down, taking charge at this point. And by mile 24, it was just down to O'Beery and who else, Zach?
Locetti,
okay? So there was just these 2 women left, and that was because their 24th mile split was 4:41.
You heard it, which is faster than all of the men, by the way.
Except for that one guy who ran.
No, his 24th was still not that fast. I'm saying that mile.
But out of all the miles in the marathon, almost period, because he ran 4:39 and they ran 4:41.
Right. Well, that was Lema ran under 4:40 pace for the entire first half. Okay. But that's a separate thing.
We're going to exclude him from that.
Yeah.
And then O'Beery, so just to give you perspective on this, her last 4 miles, I just want to let you know what they are because they're so impressive. Mile 23 was 4:57, mile 24 was 4:41, and mile 25 was 4:54. And then finally she ran her last mile in 4:51, and that's where she broke free of Locetti, and it was an incredible finish because they were sprinting, guys. Like, this is faster than I've ever run a mile in my entire life. They're sprinting down to the finish line.
Just so incredible.
It is absolutely wild.
In perspective, what was their fastest 5K?
Helen O'Beery's fastest 5K was 15:06 between 35K and 40K.
That's after all those hills.
15:06. I'm saying it again for emphasis because that is so fast. That would win most 5K races in the world. I mean, I'm talking about like smaller ones, I guess, because the 5K, the BAA 5K, she would have been third with that 5K time, which it was a stacked professional field, okay? She would have been third in the professional 5K field with her time between 35K and 40K.
So we got to remember something here, and this goes back to like years ago, someone was commenting about, because people are always astounded with how like you can see runners finishing races that are long distance races and crazy fast. And the answer to that is actually fairly simple. And it is, insofar as a runner aerobically stays underneath a certain line of exertion, of effort, then our maximum possible effort for like something like in this case 4 miles doesn't really change even if we've just run 20 miles as long as they are easy enough.
But the problem is with a race, with a course like this, is that usually it's the firing, it's not the systems that go, it's muscular
it's
fatigue.
One and the same in terms of the point that's being made.
Yeah.
So if in this case clearly Helen O'Beery was prepared to run on hills, she does live and train in Colorado, so it's not surprising she can handle hills. It clearly didn't take much out of her to run those hills, and it didn't take much out of her to run at the effort they were doing for the first 20 miles in general, because she just then goes and dominates these last 5 miles, four especially. Yeah, amazing.
Which begs the speculation of how she'll do in Paris, because Paris is a hilly course. Although she doesn't have the fastest time, there are, I think, a few more ahead of her in time. Her ability to run a course like this is a really good indication of her potential to place really well, if not get gold, at the Olympic Games.
Yeah, time matters for almost nothing when it comes to Olympic marathons anyway, because you just don't have, you don't have the situations where people are able to run fat. You know, it's hot because it's always in the summer, and it's almost always in a place where when it, you're in the summer, it's hot. We need to go back to Sydney again for the Summer Olympics sometime soon. Get back to the Southern Hemisphere. But anyway, point is, yeah, this looks good. Looks good for the summer. Now, do you know for sure, is she running Paris?
That is what this, I was reading articles and they were all speculating that she would be the number one pick for Kenya.
Well, there's no way she's not asked to be on the team, because she's 3 for 3 now in world majors and by far one of the greatest running talents in the history of time. So
she's
that
3 for 4, but 3 in a row.
That's what I mean. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So Boston, she won Boston last year, so she's a returning champion, and then she also won New York.
Yep.
Speaking of Olympics and all that might go down there, Helen O'Beery was very flattering to her countrywoman, Sharon Lochetti, who was second place, who she, you know, duked it out with there in the end, running super fast, saying that she advocates for Lochetti as part of the Kenyan team, because this isn't decided yet. Mm-hmm. And Lochetti is like more on the, like, she's not a sure thing like Helen is with her wins. Yeah. But saying, like, this is a really hard course, it's similar to Paris, it would be a great showing for our country if Lochetti and I were running. So yep. She didn't use those words. I'm not saying a quote here, but in the essence of it, that's what she was
saying.
Well,
and they are pals, apparently. They're close friends, have been for a long time.
Yeah, so. I guess it was Lochetti during the broadcast that said that Lochetti was the one who told Helen O'Beery that she should move to the U.S. to Colorado to train. So I thought that was an interesting thing.
Very nice.
Yeah. Third place was Edna Kiplagat. Love this, that she's 44 years old and she's crushing it. It's her first top three at a major since she won the 2021 Boston Marathon. In fact, she's a two-time Boston champion. So she's no stranger to the podium, but I love that she's 44 and still running fast and strong.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I should mention how our U.S. women did. Should I do that?
Let's That's do up it. To you.
All right. 12th place, first American was Emma Bates, 15th Sarah Hall, and 16th Des Linden.
So in that, it should be noted that when that giant pack of women was still together, Sarah Hall and Emma Bates were with the pack just about the entire time. Hall started to fade in the midst of the middle of those hills. Des Linden was close and at times ahead of the pack as well, because the pack was kind of fluctuating in its pace. But all three of them ended up finishing really close together, which is kind of fascinating too, just different paths towards similar ends in that case.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on off of Boston for a little bit here, just to briefly inform you of some other crazy things, including Colin Salmon of Northern Arizona University at the NCAA level ran the number 2 fastest 1500 all time. Colin Salmon is a sophomore at NAU.
Wow.
And if you recall, was as a freshman, was one of the more anticipated. We've had a few of these over the years lately, but one of the more anticipated recruits into the NCAA after an outstanding high school career, sub-4 miler as a high schooler, all that. Well, Salmon had a rocky freshman year. Just wasn't great. Didn't really look wonderful. And you don't expect a collegian to just like rise to prominence super quickly. It always takes a little while. But he just showed up big, and he ran 3:33 and change. He missed the NCAA record by under 0.2 seconds.
Wow. And a sophomore.
As That's a sophomore.
Amazing.
Yeah, so that looks good. And he's got plenty of NAU teammates doing amazing things, and the likes of Nico Young and others. So it's just, it's the place to be these days. Also, though, Hilda Olamomoy of Alabama just nearly ran the NCAA record in the 5,000 meters as well, running the number two time. And Olamomoy has been kind of just like slightly off the radar because of having to contend with the likes of Caitlin Tui and then Parker Valby. And at the same time, Olamomoy is always right there.
Yeah.
Like if she's not first, she's second or third in pretty much everything. And so to see her just continue to get faster like this now it just raises the threat level when it comes to the NCAA championships this year. And whoever says Parker Valby is a shoe-in, I guarantee you got to be careful about that. Which, by the way, I don't know if we mentioned it, but Parker Valby set the NCAA record in the 10,000. Did we talk about that?
This week? No.
No, I don't think we talked about it. So Parker Valby broke the 10,000 meter NCAA record by a lot. She crushed it. It was like 28 seconds.
That's so much.
Yes. And yet still didn't qualify for the Olympics because the Olympic standard is 10 seconds.
It's a
faster.
Very aggressive standard. It's
really fast. But I just like, I see that and I'm just like, oh my goodness, there's nothing she can't do now. And then there was more talk like, okay, well, what is she really doing in training? Because she's the one that everyone says, like, she barely runs, just cross trains all the time. But even then, they say she just cross trains all the time. But she's, like, running on an underwater treadmill, which is still running. I know it's not the same as running on ground, but she's still doing the running thing. But anyway, yeah, I guess that there's been more talk.
I'm guessing she has a really high aerobic engine. I bet she does a lot. I mean, there are pieces to the puzzle, and she is putting those pieces together. It's not like,
yeah. Yep.
It's not like she's not doing training.
Quick side note: in Division Two of the NCAA, the 5,000 meter record was also set for that division. And the reason I bring it up is not just because it happened from Adams State Romain Legendre. Legendre? It's French. How do you say that, Andy? You know French better than I do.
Legendre.
Okay, so he ran 13:16, which is not far off of the Division One NCAA record. So that's why I bring it up. It's like, oh my goodness, that's way up there. So really fast things happening in the college level. Okay, last note here, because we like to share some brief articles to give you,
especially
a kind
when
of
they
idea.
Support Zach's ideas.
No, not always and not only. There were a bunch of articles about dogs that we decided not to include because
we don't have a dog.
We also don't really care much to talk about running with dogs.
However, bet there's a lot of you who would be very interested, and I like dogs. It's just that's not something that we are very familiar with to speak about. So, but let's continue on with this.
I'm quite familiar with other people running with their dogs near me.
Okay.
But anyway, so this one shared by Bill. Thank you, Bill. Sent it to us, bring it to our attention, and it was an article by Run by Outside, and they were looking at Strava. And specifically, the behaviors of professional runners in relation to Strava. And one of the trends the author's noting is that it seems to be the case that professional runners tend to make their Strava accounts private more often than not. And they were curious about it. So they started interviewing a bunch of them, including Emma Bates and Sarah Hall, who are in the Boston Marathon. They interviewed a handful and wanted to get the different perspectives. And so you've got the likes of Bates and Hall, who don't do a lot of posting. Actually, I don't think Hall has Strava at all, I think she said. But she will occasionally post information about her training on Instagram. And then you've got like Seidel, who is private, but also on Strava. And then Kira D'Amato, who is
public on Strava.
Public on Strava, which is, you know, so what's her rationale and such. And then Kate Grace came into the equation too, because she's been one who has been public and private on Strava at different times.
Yeah. She switches it back and forth.
So the question largely was, why are you going private sometimes, or why are you keeping it public? What do you feel about it? What do you think about that?
Because people look at their training and they speculate, and there is no, like, we talk about protecting our mental space, and it's just not helpful to have so many people trying to interpret your training too. For these professional runners, they'll even be publicly putting things on forums and things. People will be trying to say whether they could break a record, or if they're like not in good shape, they'll be like, what's up with this person? They must have something going on. And that could really mess with your psyche. And really the only person that you need to be sharing your training with is your coach, Or if you're evaluating your own training, that's super helpful. That's a very good thing to do. Or maybe like another trusted person in your life who knows about running and has studied it. So everyone else's opinions can get in the way of someone having a healthy view of their training.
Apparently Molly Seidel also had people showing up on her runs because, you know, the map shows right. you where you are. So there's a few things. I mean, I've said this before and I'll say it every time you get an article like this, you always get some like, here, let's bring in an expert on something. And that expert on something apparently has something authoritative to say about this. And in this case, their expert was like, yeah, you know, there's pros and cons. And this is what they do every time, right? There's some good and there's some bad. And you just have to really make sure that you do things in a way that is good and not bad. And every time I'm just always like, but is it really worth it? All of this, like, but that bad stuff is pretty bad and it's super not helpful. And the good stuff you can achieve in other ways. And so I just wonder why we're trying so hard to make this thing good when it's so easily bad. And even if it's good sometimes, it's going to be bad sometimes also.
So she said she did give a suggestion of making it so that only you can see your own stuff if you wanted to use it as like a training log. Because I do see that it's a good thing, like for automatically being able to log what you're doing and not, and you don't miss as much of your narrative when it comes to your training. If you're like me and have a hard time keeping track of everything, I think it's nice because it does it for you automatically.
Yeah, but whatever device you're using to record, it probably is doing that in another place anyway. So it's just, it's redundant.
No, not always. So what probably. I'm saying, and then also I do have to say there is a part of like being supportive of other people too, and having like give it, I do think there is something about like saying good job, like that's cool, like to be able in everyday training, sometimes we have a lot of solo work that we're doing, to have someone else see what you're doing, it does feel good that others like care that
that's
you
my
know.
Point though, that is good, but that can be achieved in other ways even better.
It's
and
true.
I maintain that that sense we get through social media is a false sense of community, and it is ultimately unhealthy. I think it can be good in some ways, but ultimately it's unhealthy. We should be getting that with people, not with interfaces as much as possible.
Erica Kemp did speak to the situation as well for pro runners, because this was specifically talking about professionals on Strava and how a lot of companies and sponsors want you to be on Strava and have like a really big following, and that it's like a catch 22, because she said that also like if you're not showing up with these really impressive workouts that sometimes like that doesn't look good for the sponsor either, or like you feel the pressure because you're doing your runs essentially in front of 20,000 people or however many followers they have, that they feel like then they have to run harder than they should, and then they're not fulfilling their training, which is like the same everybody has. I guess that thing is like a pressure that everyone feels, like I want to show up and have a good looking workout, but it doesn't matter what it looks like. It only matters that we're putting in the correct amount of stimulus in order to get our growth. So anyway.
And also, as long as you're the one doing the workout, Andy, it's always good looking.
Oh.
Now on that note, we have addressed it and you know what we think about it. And that's probably enough at the moment. But we've got more. We've got more because next week, Andy's talking with Dakota Lindworm and you do not want to miss it.
Don't want to miss it. There's a Good. Lot of things that we talked about in the last 3 weeks that she brings up, and she ties it into her Olympic trials race, where she qualified to be part of Team USA and will compete at the Paris Olympics in the marathon.
So with that, we want to hear your thoughts, comment on the places, or send us questions via the email questions@A2ZRunning.com so that we can interact as much as possible with you.
Thank you all for joining us, and talk to you next week.